Hi, I'm Ray Novak with ICOM N9JA, and I'm here with...
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Frizzell, W2NAF, an associate professor at the University of Scranton.
And you're just not anywhere at the University of Scranton, are you?
That's right. I'm actually in the Ham Radio Shack, W3USR. And it's overlooking beautiful downtown Scranton, and we've got a great HF, VHF, UHF station, lots of ICOM radios here. It's beautiful.
So, Nathaniel, you're an associate professor there at the University of Scranton. How did you get involved with amateur radio?
Well, it started when I was back in seventh or eighth grade. I was in Boy Scouts, and I went to a camporee that happened to correspond with the Jamboree on the Air weekend, one cold, wet, rainy October. And there was a cabin out in Glen Grey, New Jersey, and N2BSA had a ham radio station set up there. And I went in and I heard him talking to people all over the world. And I just thought that was really interesting. So it captured my interest, and I eventually studied, got my license, and pursued a career in ionospheric physics.
So ionospheric sciences, before I screw anything up to try to explain what that is, I'm going to leave it to the experts. So tell me, what is it that you do?
So I try to understand how the upper atmosphere, the electrified portion of the upper atmosphere, changes and behaves with respect to inputs from space, like solar flares and geomagnetic storms, and from the lower atmosphere, from things like gravity waves and the polar vortex and other things like that.
So things like why we see the northern lights and how that changes, and why some nights you can hear AM radio from hundreds, if not thousands of miles away.
That's right.
Yeah, I remember growing up in Mississippi, and my dad had won a little transistor radio that he gave me. And I loved listening to WLS out of Chicago. And it was just mind-blowing after I started learning the sciences, once I got my ham radio license, on how all of that was possible.
Mm.
So back to being that Boy Scout, and you said that cold, dreary October day. Mm-hmm. Were you like, wow, this is cool?
Yeah, I just went in the cabin, and he had a little radio set up there, and he had a little dipole strung up in the trees. And I just heard lots of static and noise and voices from faraway places. And I just thought that was really fascinating.
So Boy Scouts, did you get your Eagle?
I did get my Eagle Scout, yes.
And your Radio Merit badge, of course, right?
Yes, I got Radio Merit badge also. And then after I got my Eagle Scout, and after I graduated from high school, and after I got my Radio Merit badge, while I was in college, I decided it would be fun to go work at a Boy Scout camp. And I didn't want to just do anything at a Boy Scout camp. I was hoping to find a place where I could actually teach radio and teach Radio Merit badge. And so I did find a place that hired me, Forestburg Scout Reservation in New York. And I worked there for 6 years as a technology center director. And I taught scouts radio. We set up W2FSR. We taught the technician license exam, we taught electricity and electronics and another number of other technical badges. And that's really where I decided that I wanted to pursue electrical engineering as a career.
Oh, very cool. So when you said that you worked to teach scouting, did you ever make it to the big show for the Boy Scouts, the Jambo?
I did. So I first went there. That's actually where I got the first part of my novice. I passed my novice written at the 1997 National Scout Jamboree. And it took me a year later to get my technician. And then but that was such a good experience that I wanted to go back on staff. And so, yes, I did end up getting to the 2005, 2010 and 2013 National Scout Jamborees on K2BSA staff.
Oh, sweet. So those years would have put you, what, at Fort AP Hill?
So Fort AP Hill was the first year. So 2005, I was at Fort AP Hill. And I think I met you there.
I've gone to a couple of them at Fort AP Hill, and then the beautiful facility, the Bechtel Summit. I think it's the BSR.
Yeah, the Bechtel Summit Reserve.
That facility is gorgeous, and the Radio Merit Badge is the only badge that you can start and finish at the Jambo, or it was the last couple of times.
Wow. Yeah.
So the last report that I saw, they were actually, scouts were giving scouts amateur radio tests. So mm-hmm. they had VE sessions, at least two VE sessions. At the Bechtel Reserve, the ham radio tent is right at the base of one of those huge zip lines. Mm-hmm. Have you ever wondered what bands you could tune up on that?
I imagine some of the very low bands. Yeah, certainly 100 meters, maybe lower.
Okay, so we talked about you going through the scouts. What happened after the scouts?
So through Boy Scouts, while I was working at Forestburg Scout Reservation, WA2FPB, he was one of my mentors there, he said that I should go get a physics degree. And the conundrum I had was I thought I wanted to do electrical engineering, but I was going to Montclair State University as an undergrad at the time, and I was majoring in music education. And so Montclair State didn't offer engineering, they offered physics. I didn't feel like changing schools. So I said, okay, I'll go add a physics major at Montclair State. And so I did that. So I ended up getting a degree in both music education and physics. And towards the end of my degree at Montclair State, I decided it would be fun to go get a PhD in electrical engineering. And
that it would be fun to get a PhD.
That's what I thought, yes. It worked out well. So I went to the Dayton Hamvention, and I met a number of students at the Dayton Hamvention from K4KDJ at Virginia Tech. And I was talking with them, and Virginia Tech seemed to have a lot of what I wanted. They had a ham radio club. They had a PhD in electrical engineering program. They were outdoorsy, which is, you know, something I like from scouts. So I applied there and they accepted me.
Oh, there you go. That sounds like a good path. And you got to find some similar minded people too.
Yeah, I did. And yeah, having the ham radio club there really helped out when I first got down to grad school.
Well, Steve Goodgame with the ARRL and I did a interview session where we talked about the importance of STEM, especially for the technical curious youth. I know mm-hmm. I know I was technically curious. I spent a lot of time in a computer lab, or we had one TRS-80 in our math room, and that there shows my age and all the guys that, oh, a TSR-80, wow. That was exciting to me, but to get into amateur radio, to see the other like-minded people, that was something that was comforting to me. Mm-hmm. How do you see what Steve's doing? And I think this will transition into part of what you guys are doing with the ARRL with HamSci. How mm-hmm. important do you see that for today's youth?
Well, I think it gives youth who are technically curious a real path where they can gain some both hands-on experience, they can meet some really good mentors, and kind of chart out a path for themselves, experiment with things that they wouldn't normally have access to. So I think it's incredibly important.
So what kind of experimentation things can you do with amateur radio?
Oh, there's so much. I focus a lot on asking the question, how does this one signal get from this part of the earth to the other part of the earth? And what sorts of things in space affect that? But other people might be interested in, you know, how can we develop some sort of new digital mode to transmit data faster or more robustly? Or, you know, how do we get my signal from this side of the mountain to that side of the mountain? There's so many different ways.
So there's a pretty big event coming up that you guys are going to be analyzing and studying that not only ham radio operators will participate in, but I remember watching something on the NASA channel where they're extremely curious about a solar anomaly.
That's right. We have a total solar eclipse coming up this April 8th, 2024.
That's going to be pretty exciting. What are you going to be doing for it?
Well, I think one thing that's important for people to know is that most people, when they hear of solar eclipses, they think of something that you want to look at or some sort of optical display. But what's really interesting is that it affects radio signals too in the ionosphere. And so what we're going to be doing is we're organizing multiple ham radio experiments on a continental scale, the United States, Canada, Mexico, all to study how the solar eclipse is affecting the ionosphere and high frequency radio waves.
Does that play into the future of space exploration?
How does it? All sorts of ways. One of the things that we want to understand in space exploration is we want to understand how the environment around us works and behaves. And that involves understanding the fundamental physics of that environment. The ionosphere and the upper atmosphere are regions of space where it's hard to get a lot of good measurements because it's so far away and it's so big and it's so inaccessible. So we want to remotely sense it. It's also hard to run controlled experiments because you just don't know exactly what the sun is going to do normally. So eclipses represent a really kind of unique opportunity for space scientists. They really represent controlled experiments because we know what the solar input to the upper atmosphere is going to be well ahead of time. And it's a very different sort of condition than, say, like dawn or dusk. It's, you know, very focused. It moves very, very quickly, just very different conditions. So we can use this as a controlled experiment to both test our understanding of upper atmospheric physics and also possibly find things that we didn't know about it before.
That's really cool. And I guess when you take a look at space exploration, well, we're paying attention to what's going on with our atmosphere and everything with a solar eclipse. It gives us an idea what to expect on other planets that will have not an atmosphere similar to ours, but at least an atmosphere. And I can guarantee you we're not the only planet that goes through a solar eclipse.
That's true. And the other thing is interesting is that upper part of the atmosphere, the ionosphere, is what we call a plasma. It's an electrified gas. And really that is one of the most dominant forms of matter in the universe. So if you go through space, that space is not a vacuum, it's actually a plasma. And then if you get to other planets, they can have plasmas in their environments too. So yes, what we understand, what we learn from looking at the plasma here on Earth could potentially also give us some insight as to what to look for in other environments as well.
So you mentioned that you're sitting inside the amateur radio shack there at University of Scranton.
Mm-hmm.
How does something like that occur?
Well, it took a lot of planning and a lot of planning and a lot of patience and asking people for the right things. But the way it happened here was I became a faculty member here, and then I wanted to put together a ham radio station. And I eventually found out in order to do it on a university type of building, you really have certain challenges that you don't necessarily have at your own personal home. You can't just throw wires up in the trees here. You have to make sure, you know, everything's up to code and has been engineered properly. So I had to write a grant, and I asked for a substantial amount of money. And then I had some people who do radio installations professionally and who are also ham radio operators do the main station design. And then I had an engineering firm do the drawings and sign off on all of the plans. And then it got it through university approval. And now we have a station.
It's funny that you'd say it's not something that a lot of hams will do. I know quite a few hams that themselves, they do exactly what you were talking about. They want it right. They don't want to take a chance if they put a tower up of the tower falling over on their property, their house, or anything like that. So it is good to hear that kind of language being spoken when you're talking about putting up a ham radio station. It's always best to engineer because you have no idea what could possibly happen.
That's right. Yeah, you really don't. I think here, you know, the university needs to be very careful to make sure everything is done right. So there's perhaps an extra level of checks than are normally required. So even if other hams do that stuff at their home, they may not be required to, even if it's a good idea.
We all do do-it-yourself type projects, and those don't always go as engineered or spec'd by code. So that is good to hear that they make you guys do that.
And the nice thing is when you go do it this way, you really get a wonderful result. I mean, I can come in the station here. You know, I know I have a great directional Yagi antenna on our tower. We have fan dipoles for the low bands. I can sit down the station. It just works. And it's great for, you know, it's really a space that I think is inspiring to students. When they come in this space, they say, wow, this is really neat. I'm enjoying being here. And I think that sort of inspiration is really what helps, something that can help to drive the interest forward.
I think something like what you did at the university is something that a lot of ham clubs, not only university ham clubs, but public ham clubs could as well, to look at how you engineer, how you design. And it then also brings in the curiosity of others that have to sign off and approve on what you're doing. Have you recruited any of the other faculty to join you?
Oh, I have. I've gotten a number of my colleagues in the physics and engineering department to become licensed and to start to be involved. I have reached across the university. I've gotten our graphics art department to help design QSL cards. So now they know what ham radio is. And I'm now working with our occupational therapy department and faculty members over there. We're working with the Lackawanna Blind Association on a project to try to bring amateur radio to people who are blind or visually impaired as well. And so now I have occupational therapy faculty and students involved also.
All right. So we mentioned about the ARRL and the wonderful things that Steve Goodgame's doing with the STEM. You are also working on a project with the ARRL called HAMSCI.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
So HAMSCI is the Ham Radio Science Citizen Investigation. And that's a group that I started back when I was in graduate school. And we're now up to about 8 years doing this. And it's a group that joins together amateur radio operators and the professional science research community. And our goal is to advance scientific knowledge about the ionosphere and space, and also to give back to ham radio.
Very cool. I remember seeing you guys. Unfortunately, you got put into a smaller room when you were first doing this with, I can see his face now, the beard, Ward Silver.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yes, Ward Silver is a big part of it.
And, I mean, when you get with a group of people, like-minded people like that, you get to see some very brilliant people.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I think that's one of the favorite parts about my job. I've gotten to interact with so many interesting and smart people, both older than me, the same age as me, younger than me. It's been really fantastic.
And you get to intermingle with people from all walks of life. It's not just a complete geek fest. I mean, you get to meet people that do many different things. I've talked to many people that are truck drivers, doctors, even a Nobel Prize winner.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true. You just never know what people's background will be or what they do. You don't necessarily know what their experiences are or have been. However, every person has an interesting story, and that's one of the neat things about doing ham science, citizen science.
It definitely is. So what do you have coming up for HamSci? What's the new hot project?
Well, right now the major focus is the solar eclipses. So we've got that coming up on April 8th. And, you know, of course, once the eclipse is done, then in a lot of ways, HamSci's work really gets started, because then it's our job to actually look at all of the data and the observations that we have made. So that's going to go on for the next couple of years. In addition to that, we're looking at all sorts of different things that affect ionospheric propagation. We have projects that look at how solar flares affect propagation. We have projects that look at how traveling ionospheric disturbances affect things. We might have a project starting up soon that's looking at trans-equatorial propagation. Just all sorts of things. And just even like every day, we've got one person who's looking at how signal-to-noise ratios can vary so greatly, you know, from just 1 minute to the next. So there's all sorts of projects happening.
And for those that all of that just went right over the top of their head, to put it in layman's terms, if you've got one of these and wonder why you've got four bars showing and you can't get any data, I bet some of the stuff that you're studying can answer those questions.
It probably can sometimes.
Because what you're studying, it does not only impact the high frequencies, it impacts all radio communications.
It does. And especially radio communications that travel through the ionosphere. So there's all sorts of communications that go via satellite. Those signals pass through the ionosphere and can get degraded or changed by the ionosphere. GPS signals can get affected by the ionosphere. In fact, we use some GPS measurements to help us study the ionosphere. So there's lots of impacts.
And everything that you just mentioned, all is radio frequency, RF.
Mm-hmm.
Transmitters and receivers, and that's what we play with every day in amateur radio.
That's right.
So if this reaches somebody that's in the scouts and they're technically curious, what advice would you give them?
I'd say study and have fun doing it. Really, I got to where I am because I found this interesting and I just kept doing it, and I figured out a way to work it into my life in such that I could actually have a career doing this. And it's been really amazing. Well, I should add to that. I'd like to add one thing to that. So as that all sounds fantastic, but the other thing to remember is, as much fun as I've had, it's not always easy. There are unique challenges that you will come across. So my advice to you is also be prepared for those challenges. When they happen, take a step back and come up with a plan or a way to meet those challenges. Don't just give up.
One other question with that. Now that I just remembered, you are a new parent.
Mm-hmm.
How did your parents help you down your pathway?
Well, they were incredibly supportive. You know, they had never really heard of ham radio when I first found out about it. And they, I know, were even a little nervous about the idea of me going and talking to all sorts of random strangers. But, you know, they learned about it, and they took me to test sessions to get my first test. They took me to radio club meetings. They bought me radios. They let me put things up on top of our house. They let some neighboring hams put stuff up on top of our house. And so all throughout that, they were just very encouraging. And I'm very grateful for that.
So all you parents out there, if you've got a young one that is technically curious, feed that passion. My youngest one, it's a funny story. My youngest one, he never really liked much about ham radio. He ended up going into the Air Force. And in tech school, they sectioned him off and put him into signal intelligence. And he and a bunch of his friends from tech school were on their way to go visit family for Christmas. And we started talking about Fourier and his theories and different things about radio related. And they start looking at me going, how do you know all of this stuff? So before we took them to the airport, we stopped by the house and I showed them a few of the radios and they're like, we're just studying theory and mathematical equations. Now we can see what the practical use case is for what we're studying. And he ended up working with satellites and studying a lot of the things that you're talking about right now. And I'm like, you could have had a head start on all of this stuff had you gotten your ham radio license.
I'm actually trying to do that right now with my communication systems and electromagnetics class. So I, in my communication systems class, instead of starting with the book on day one, I brought them up to the new ham radio station here. And I showed them the different systems and I had them get their radio licenses. I had them use narrow antenna, listen to the ISS, you know, learn the basic theory that they need and practical skills that they need to make satellite communications, learn about sideband and AM and FM from the radio side. Now we're going back into the classroom. Now I'm starting to show them the math for Fourier transforms. I'm starting to show them the math behind AM and AM modulation and sideband. And now when I'm showing them the equations, they're not falling asleep in class. They're going, oh, now that makes sense. I understand, you know, seeing that on the actual radios.
Yeah, that practical use case really helps out, helps people get their head around it even more. So we've talked about everything that you're doing, what got you there. The one thing that we almost forgot to do was show us the ham shack.
That's right. So this is the W3USR ham radio station here at the University of Scranton. And we have over here, this is our HF station, and it's a little backlit, but you can see we've got an amplifier over there, and then we have the beautiful ICOM 7610 HF radio over here, and then we have some Vibraplex keys and paddles over there. And one of the things that's nice about this station is you have an absolutely gorgeous view of downtown Scranton.
Wow, that's incredible.
Oh my gosh, it's absolutely beautiful. I love bringing people up here just so they can see that. And it's really nice having a station where you look up and it's an inspiring view and not just a cinder block wall. So we're very fortunate. And then if you come over here, we have our VHF UHF station. So we have an ICOM 7300 that we have hooked up to our 6 meter antenna. And then we have the Azel rotor, which is connected to some M-squared long boom Yagi, circularly polarized for satellite work. And then we have the ICOM 9700 over there. And so that's our main VHF UHF station.
So what is your view to Europe look like?
The view to Europe, that is a good question. So that is going over that way. So there are some mountains over to the east. There's something called East Mountain over there. So it's maybe not totally flat, but we still do all right. Because as I said, if you, I guess if you go up the valley over here, you got
there. We go. Show us that view there.
Yeah, there's that straight up the valley, kind of north, pointing northeast. So that's kind of toward Europe. So. You know, we get some very nice signals coming in.
And what does it look like pointing due north?
Pointing due north, that's pretty much straight up the valley there. So the valley runs, kind of north-south. And then there's a mountain to the west, but it's still kind of, you know, off in the horizon a little bit. And then there's a mountain to the east, which here all you can see is the chalkboard. But, right. You know, you go out there. And then the antennas are on a 40-foot tower on top of this building. So this building's 5 stories tall, and then there's a 40-foot tower on top of that. And we have a DX Engineering Skyhawk Yagi for 10, 15, 20.
Well, looking at all the steel and concrete below that tower and the elevation of that tower, your angle of radiation is much different than what it would be if it was just a 72-foot tower off the ground.
Yes, I would think so.
One of the things that I think you should get for your station there is what we call a great circle map.
Yes.
That way you can see, everybody thinks, well, Europe is east of us. Mm-hmm. And Australia is southeast.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at a great circle map, it could really cause you to start thinking differently. I learned that when I moved to Washington State. I'm thinking, well, it's going to be tough to get to the East Coast from here. I've got to point the antenna east and all the East Coasters. And then somebody goes, use your great circle map and look at where Europe is. And I'm like, oh, actually the one hop, the single hop for 20 meters is right over the polar cap.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a little bit of the polar noise, and but made work in Europe a lot easier instead of pointing east.
Yeah, I think, you know, I noticed that just before we got on here, because I was looking at the waterfall display. I had the antenna due east, and I didn't really see anything on 10 meters. I set it up to, northeast. Right now it's at about 45, 50 degrees azimuth. And all of a sudden, all these signals just showed up out of the noise. So, you know, one thing, I've been a ham now for quite some time, now 25, 26 years, but I've never had a really good directional antenna before. And so this is my first time actually getting to really kind of have my own. And it's a really wonderful experience to just spin the dial, spin the rotor, and just see the signals, you know, pop up and disappear.
When you got an antenna with a real good front to back ratio, the directional becomes very important.
Yes.
You really don't hear much off the side of the Yagi. And I always wondered, well, I'm talking to you off the back of the Yagi, and I'm sitting there thinking, boy, you don't have good front to back ratio.
Yeah.
Time to upgrade to something a little bit better, because my best signal should be coming off the front of you.
Yeah. But I think one of the neat technologies that's really come about just in the past, I'd say 10 to 15 years, are these waterfall displays that you see on all the radios now, because now I can look at the entire band and I can spin the Yagi and I can just see the signals across the entire band come up or go down. Whereas before you could just listen on one frequency. So it really is neat seeing what a dramatic difference that directionality makes.
And then teaching about signal to noise ratios and how in a very noisy environment, you can improve the capability of your receiver by doing something like having a directional antenna, whether it's a Yagi, a four square, or for the low bands, getting a beverage antenna set up.
Right. Absolutely.
So Dr. Nathaniel Frizzell, thank you very much for coming to join us on Radios in Action. While we really didn't show any radios in action, my angle on it is more, what can you do with radios and what will it motivate others to do? So I greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ray. And thank you so much for inviting me on here. It was a pleasure speaking to you. And I wish you all the best with your work. And I wish I'd like to say 73 to all of the people who are listening.
73.
73.